I'm Robert McKim, head of the Department of Religion, and my colleagues and I, along with our staff in our department and our students, are delighted to have you with us this evening, and we thank you for coming. In our department, we have numerous events throughout the year, and you can learn about these and keep up with what we're doing, if you wish, by making regular visits to our website or by getting on our mailing list, if you're not already on it. And to do that, just send a request to religion@illinois.edu. I want to mention in particular that we actually have quite a few interesting events coming up in the next few weeks, and you're cordially invited to all of them. These include a major symposium on Islam and the Salvation of Non-Muslims, a lecture on Hinduism and religious diversity, another on Hinduism and ecology, and yet another on Christianity by one of our colleagues in anthropology. That's all coming up in the next few weeks. So we have many events, but the intellectual high point of our academic year and the event for which we plan with the greatest care is the visit of our Marjorie Hall Thulin Scholar of Religion and Contemporary Culture and the annual Thulin Lecture, which is the high point of that visit. Our plan for this evening is to, first of all, have the lecture, followed by some questions and discussion, and followed in turn by a reception directly outside to which everyone is invited. Now, to open this evening's proceedings, I would like to introduce Professor Karen Carney, Associate Dean of our College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, who's graciously agreed to say a few words on behalf of our college. Karen.
Thank you. On behalf of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, I'm very pleased to welcome you to the 2010 Marjorie Hall Thulin Lecture on Religion and Contemporary Culture. As someone who is not only an employee of the college, but also one of its alumni, I'd like to take this opportunity to note that our speaker tonight, Dr. Sabina Elkhair, is herself a graduate of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. I'm sure that the late Mrs. Marjorie Hall Thulin, also an LAS alumna whose generous gift has made this event possible, would have loved the idea of having the LAS alumni so well represented at tonight's event. Marjorie Hall Thulin, as you'll see from your brochure, earned her baccalaureate degree from the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences in 1931. And went on to have a successful career in advertising. She was also a writer who published poetry, children's literature, and a local history of Glencoe, where she lived for many years. Mrs. Thulin also had a deep and abiding interest in religion. She wanted students at her alma mater to understand how religion grows and functions in a complex society, and this led her to endow a fund establishing the Marjorie Hall Thulin Scholar of Religion and Contemporary Culture. Each year, her gift makes it possible for us to bring to campus an internationally recognized scholar. During his or her visit, the Thulin visiting scholar meets with Illinois faculty and students and delivers a public lecture for the university and broader community. Recent Thulin scholars have included prominent scholars such as David Loy, a scholar of Buddhism, Catholic theologian Charles Curran, Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, and of course, tonight's speaker, Dr. Sabina Elkhair of the University of Oxford. Before I turn things back over to Professor McKim, I would like to introduce, and who will introduce Ms. Elkhair more formally, I'd like to pause a moment just to appreciate the opportunity of events like tonight's talk. Lectures like this one that encourage us to think about the place of religion in modern culture and society are vitally important to our understanding of ourselves and the world. And we're grateful to the generosity of Marjorie Hall Thulin for making such an event possible. Thank you.
For many years at these annual Thulin events, we had Mrs. Thulin with us, always in the front row and always thoroughly engaged. Now, in her absence, we have an excellent way to honor her memory. This is just to make the Thulin Lecture one in which we deal with some of the most important issues of our time and do so under the guidance of a leading expert. And that, I'm happy to say, is our situation this evening. I read the following last month in an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education. What makes someone poor? Among those who study poverty, the answer has long been a lack of money. If your income falls below a certain level, you're poor. Researchers study extreme poverty and chronic poverty, but the basic assumption is the same. What's in your wallet is what matters. But maybe there's more to it. Maybe poverty is about not having enough food, access to health care, reliable transportation, adequate sanitation, and a dozen other things that make life bearable. The so-called multidimensional approach has been getting a lot of attention lately from both academics and government officials who wonder if the way we've been measuring poverty for decades has been, if not wrong, then perhaps incomplete. The article in the Chronicle continues. At the forefront of this change in thinking are two economists, James E. Foster, a professor of economics and international affairs at George Washington University, and Sabina Alkire, director of the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative at the University of Oxford. A paper they wrote in 2007 may help redefine what it means to be poor. Mexico has adopted the method outlined in the paper as its official poverty measure. Bhutan is using it to create a national happiness index. Other countries like Chile have likewise indicated interest, as have officials at the World Bank, who are considering where else the approach might work. The method that they developed allows researchers to create categories deemed important to well-being, like access to healthcare, education, food, and so on. The article goes on to comment on the ways in which the Foster-Alkire model is being used in Bhutan, and to comment on responses from people in the World Bank and elsewhere. And this article is just one of numerous indicators of the significance and impact of the work of our speaker this evening. Dr. Sabina Alkire grew up here in Champaign and studied here at the University of Illinois, also at Oxford, where she was a Rhodes Scholar. At Oxford, she completed her master's degree in theology and in economics for development, and a doctorate in economics. She's coordinated a major World Bank research initiative on culture and poverty. She served as research writer for the Commission on Human Security at the United Nations, and she's been a research associate at the Global Equity Initiative at Harvard. As I mentioned, she now directs the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative, a research center within the University of Oxford that was launched in 2006. Her numerous publications include the 2002 book, Valuing Freedom's Sans Capability Approach and Poverty Reduction, a co-edited book in 2008 called The Capability Approach, Concepts, Measures, and Applications, and numerous papers that focus on Sen's work on dimensions of human development, on the capability approach, and on multidimensional measures of poverty and well-being, and many related matters. One of her latest projects is a new multidimensional poverty measure for over 100 countries that the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative has developed for the United Nations Development Programme. This will be released in June. In fact, I think she finished her work on this around midnight last night. So when I say it's her latest work, not only am I referring to its recentness, but also the time of day at which she finished it late last night. She and her group work closely with the governments of many countries. They've had an especially close relationship with the leadership in Bhutan, where Dr. Alkire has advised them on the development of their gross national happiness index. In addition to all of her other work, Dr. Alkire is also an Anglican priest and has her own parish in Oxford, an Anglo-Catholic parish with a socially active focus. In addition, she's a chaplain at Magdalen College at Oxford. It's a great pleasure to introduce as our 2010 Thulin Scholar, a graduate of our university who stands for the social causes for which she stands. The title of her lecture this evening is How an Adequate Notion of Human Flourishing Challenges Economics. Please join me in extending a very warm welcome to our 2010 Marjorie Hall Thulin Scholar, Dr. Sabina Alkire.
Thank you very much for such kind and overly kind introductions. I'm very grateful to the Department of Religion and to Robert McKim in particular for the opportunity to be here at the U of I and back home in the world's best hotel, and also to meet with the students and faculty and others during the rest of the week. Marjorie Hall Thulin so generously created a space for reflection, a space simply to ponder how the religious faiths could help us to navigate central cultural and social challenges with some kind of wisdom and creativity. In Medusa and the Snail, Lewis Thomas argues that open spaces, such as this one, actually induce social changes. He writes, "We pass the word around. We ponder how the case is put by different people. We read the poetry. We meditate over the literature. We play the music. We change our minds. We reach an understanding. Society evolves this way, not by shouting each other down, but by the unique capacity of unique individual human beings to comprehend each other." So I look forward to our interchange in that spirit this evening, and I'm grateful for this opportunity. Many across the political and professional spectrum argue that economics is poised to change. The October 2009 newsletter of the Royal Economic Society in the UK suggested that, I quote, "the impact of the recession among economists might last longer than the recession itself." The financial crisis, combined with global climate change, poverty, and neuroeconomics, to name just a few influences, had fractured the status quo. The title of this talk is "How an Adequate Notion of Human Flourishing Challenges Economics." For given that economics is in transition, what is the likelihood, I ask, that new economic frameworks will advance a richer conception of well-being, one that is more adequate in a human sense and perhaps also in a religious sense? I have what I believe to be consistent but disparate answers to this question. I believe that the likelihood that economics will address richer aspects of well-being is the highest it has been for decades, and I believe that the likelihood is still very low, partly because practical issues have not been thought through and research has not been coordinated. And so this evening, I would like to think with you about what an economics would look like that did have a more adequate notion of the flourishing of a human life. And I draw on Amartya Sen's works, including his book last summer, The Idea of Justice, and put that together with the new natural law approach in jurisprudence developed by John Finnis to sketch a framework for a more adequate account of human flourishing. But as mentioned just now, I believe that a more humane economics, although desirable and widely called for, is unlikely. Why? And in closing tonight, I will identify some of what seem to be key bottlenecks, binding constraints that would need to be addressed not only by economists, but by citizens and activists outside the profession for the field to move in this direction. The binding constraints are of different shapes and sizes. Some have to do with data, some with organization of our profession, and some with political economy. But however large or small, fussy or profound, expensive or incidental they may seem, they block progress. So first, I hope to convince you that the likelihood that economics would consider an adequate notion of human well-being is the highest it has been for decades. Why do I say this? A good place to start is to look over the shoulder of some contemporary leading economists and hear their analysis after the financial crisis of this profession. Bear in mind our starting point. Economics, a student t-shirt reads, makes astrology look respectable. For we have a professional habit of looking ridiculous. To give only one example, in 2003, Nobel laureate Robert Lucas in economics declared that the central problem of depression prevention has been solved for all practical purposes. But one clear call after the financial crisis, therefore, was for economists to see the bigger picture. In his presidential address to the European Economic Association this summer, Lord Nicholas Stern said, "If you look at the giants of our profession, many of them strode across the discipline. All were capable of talking and thinking about different bits of the economy in a striking way." In contrast, at present, economists each specialize in our own little patch, weed it, cultivate it, pick its strawberries, and become king of it. This creates depth and expertise, but curtails vision. The Queen of England, when visiting the London School of Economics after the crisis, politely asked a pointed question. Why didn't economists anticipate the financial crisis? In response, Professors Besley and Hennessy and other economists prepared a public letter. Their central conclusion is this, quote, "The failure was principally a failure of the collective imagination to understand the risks to the system as a whole." Simply put, quote, "Economists frequently lost sight of the bigger picture." So one problem is that the field of economics is dispersed and we do not know how our work is connected to others' work. Perhaps because of this, another critical strand within the current rumblings in the field is the sense that economists have become too willing to justify what they are told. Many of you will know the much beloved passage of Keynes, even beloved by economists who do not like Keynes. The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood, Keynes wrote. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. But by last summer, the self-importance among economists had perhaps been a bit diminished. Nick Stern went so far as to reverse Keynes's quote. He claimed that in recent times, it is economists who have been the slaves of defunct politicians. And Harvard's Darren Acemoglu wrote of economists in the past decade, quote, "We let policymakers' policies and rhetoric set the agenda for our thinking about the world, and worse, perhaps even for our policy advice." So economics seems to be poised to change. And further, of direct relevance to our topic this evening, the appetite for change is somewhat broader than an interesting feature in the popular response to the financial crisis. It's that people have called not only for the reinstallation of a stable economy, but also for one that is indeed more humane. Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate in economics, was former chair of the Council of Economic Advisers under Clinton and chief economist of the World Bank. But his latest book, Freefall, characteristically does not mince words when it comes to that profession of which he is very much a central figure. He writes, "It is said that a near-death experience forces one to re-evaluate priorities and values. The global economy has just had a near-death experience. The crisis exposed not only flaws in the prevailing economic model, but also flaws in our society. Too many people had taken advantage of others." Stiglitz argues that, quote, "We should take this moment as one of reckoning and reflection, of thinking about what kind of society we would like to have, and ask ourselves, are we creating an economy that is helping us achieve those aspirations?" And so he closed Freefall, this book, with the hope that learning from the financial crisis
we would create a new society in which each individual is able to fulfill his sick aspirations and live up to the potential, in which we have created citizens who live up to shared ideals and values, in which we have created a community that treats our planet with the respect that in the long run it will surely demand. These are, he writes, the opportunities of this time, and the real danger now is that we will not seize them. And so it is in this context that I think there might be space for engagement by religious thinkers, political thinkers, philosophical thinkers, and people of goodwill outside the profession to influence the ideals towards which it will work as it reforms. In terms of trying to seize opportunities, let me turn to one final example from the contemporary scene. France's President Sarkozy asked another Nobel laureate, Amartya Sen, and Joseph Stiglitz to lead a recent commission on how to improve GDP as a measure of the economy. GDP is the gross domestic product, the most common measure of economic performance, as well as, perhaps wrongly, of social progress. The report was released recently and contained proposals for better measures of national accounts, of environmental costs, and of the quality of life. And the response reflected perhaps a public hunger for economics to recover its link to well-being and fulfillment. As Stiglitz wrote in his op-ed in the Financial Times, hopefully the work of our commission will have increased the impetus to align the metrics of well-being with what really contributes to the quality of life, and in doing so, help us direct our efforts at those things that really matter. But what would economics look like if it did direct its efforts at, quote, those things that really matter, at human flourishing broadly defined? This is, in fact, the precise question on which Amartya Sen, the Nobel laureate that I mentioned before, and others have worked for over 30 years. And so in the next 10 minutes, I would like to outline briefly his views, the space he has opened. But first with a warning, it is a question that he poses, that he investigates, but that he does not answer. For it is his conviction that the question should not be answered by an economist, nor by any figure in authority, the same at any one point in time. For it is a question that is best answered again and again by people of different ages, of different cultures, of different faiths and backgrounds, posing to themselves and one another the questions of the shape of the society they would like to create, trying to articulate that, and then guiding the economists in terms of the metrics to support them in that endeavor. And so the primary, one of the pivotal pieces of his work is an appreciation, a constructive appreciation of the diversity of values that exist and will continue to exist within a society. And so an account of human flourishing that tries to welcome the expression of disagreement and of diverse understandings of human flourishing rather than articulate one precise view of that objective. The idea, the nub, the central piece of Sen's ideas is that markets, trade, and economic growth, that economic development, that all of this should be explicitly designed to advance well-being, rather than human beings being cogs in a wheel, the objective of which is to advance economic growth. That should be turned around. Growth is the instrumental, the means that should be used to advance the objective, the end, the telos of human flourishing. And this idea goes back at least to Aristotle in the 4th century and to Kautilya in the Economics of India. Aristotle argued that we should judge between a good political arrangement and a bad one by considering its success and failure in enabling people to lead what he called flourishing lives. and that is also the case for economic gains. Aristotle wrote, "Wealth is evidently not the good we are seeking, for it is merely useful and for the sake of something else." And those who pioneered quantitative economics also aimed initially to advance a wider understanding of human flourishing. William Petty, François Quesnay, Nicolas de Condorcet, and Arthur Cecil Pigou. The focus on people's well-being as the economic objective, the objective of economic activity, was also apparent in, although people may not learn it in economics now, the writings of Adam Smith, of David Ricardo, Karl Marx, and John Stuart Mill. Adam Smith expressed a concern for equity, writing that no society can surely be flourishing and happy of which the greater part of the members are poor and miserable. And Smith was also mindful, as Sen very much is, that economic activities should foster not only a material well-being, but individual agency and creativity. He objected to work that never allowed a worker to exert their understanding or exercise their invention. So building on this tradition within the profession, Sen argues that economics should aim to expand people's freedoms, the worthwhile capabilities that they value, and it should also aim to empower people as agents to engage actively in these economic and social processes. And it should do so in a way that advances equity, efficiency, sustainability, respect for human rights, responsibility, and other key principles. So that's the core, the nux, of his approach. And I'd like to take a couple moments just to spell out the key concepts that he puts in place. Capabilities refer to people's real freedoms. It's perhaps an awkward term, but a term that he has defined precisely. Flourishing people are able to enjoy activities and states of being that they value and that they have reason to value. And any resources, any income, any institutions are vitally important means, and yet ultimately success is to be evaluated in the currency of people's lives. And so this concept has two parts: functionings, the word is from Aristotle, and freedom. So the freedom aspect refers to people's actual ability to achieve something. It's not a paper freedom. The capability to enjoy primary education requires that there be a school, that there be teachers, that those teachers be qualified to teach, that they turn up, that they teach, and that students not be prohibited from attending by user costs, by danger at school or on the way to school, by discrimination against them on the basis of gender or race or religion. And so the real opportunity does need to ascertain that it is a freedom people could actually enjoy. Opportunity freedom also allows people who do not wish to enjoy a functioning to refrain from it. People who wish to fast in order to express political solidarity or to fulfill a religious commitment should be able to fast rather than eat a nutritious meal if they wish. Freedom and functionings. Functionings, this word is strange to our ears, but it simply means the beings and doings that a person can enjoy. Nargis, a female participant in a literacy program in the peri-urban slums of Lahore, said that I learned that carrots are good for you. They are cheaper than apples, but they are more nutritious. She had learned something. It was a piece of knowledge, and that for her was a functioning. Others might be being well-nourished, playing basketball, listening to music, or working in the lab. So Sen's capability approach is not limited to the basic aspects that I certainly tend to work on in poverty, but it can include complex and higher functionings as well. The other quality of functionings is that they are things people value and have reason to value. So on the one hand, they have to be what people of whatever culture or individual personality or value structure actually value. If they do not value them, they are not a functioning. They are defined away from that set. But But of course, we value many things that perhaps we do not have reason to value. We value things that hurt, that exclude, that dominate, that violate other people, and that hurt our own and others' long-term interests on this planet. And people's values conflict. So Sen never specifies who has the authority to decide what we have reason to value, and many would wish that he would. But he does create space to ask this question of what we have reason to value, and to put that question front and central in our evaluation of our own objectives, economic and social. So that's the first part of the objective. It's to expand the capabilities that people value and have reason to value. And the second aspect of his account of human flourishing is that we see people not as the victims of cunning economic or development programs, but as active agents who are able to shape their own lives and destinies. Too often, perhaps particularly in poverty work, the poor, the destitute, the oppressed are seen as victims, people with needs, but their own talents, leadership, articulate voice is not recognized and therefore not cultivated, to the detriment of those people and of their societies. So Sen argues that economics must deliberately recognize people as agents, both personally within families and communities, and collectively in public debate, shared action, and democratic practice. While the spaces for agency will vary across cultures, they can be empowered to advance the common good and enabled to have voice and participate in some kind of public processes. So economics, on the one hand, aims to expand capabilities, and on the other hand, aims to continue to see people as active agents. And that's one of the reasons that Sen does not specify precisely his approach, but relies on the agency of people through space and time to do so themselves. And he, by leaving it underspecified, practices what he preaches, encourages that agency to come forward. Clearly, different nations and communities will emphasize different capabilities, different dimensions of the human good, different principles and forms of agency than others. And so their own economy will carry the melody of their culture, of their values, and their current priorities. Indeed, the concepts, poems, and speeches of different intellectuals and public figures may be drawn upon to articulate these goals that already have existed over time. And we could think of people in this country who have done so. And so the account of human flourishing that Sen tries to sketch is not one size fits all. It's flexible and it is responsive. Yet all of its forms will offer people more opportunities and foster their ability to shape their own lives and to advance justice across society, both in the present and in the future. The third aspect of Sen's approach I will not touch on or develop in very much detail, but it is in a sense the centerpiece of his book, The Idea of Justice. And it is that as we try to advance the good of different human beings, we need to then be able to judge between human groups, be able to judge their good across time, and be able to think about different, what he would call, principles. And so rather than focusing only on efficiency, Sen argues that we need to keep different principles in mind. Things like, as I mentioned, equity, sustainability, responsibility, respect for human rights, and other principles. But he argues that we do not need to select among them. Rather, we can use these principles to weed out options that are immoral or that are suboptimal for the society. And then it is a free choice among them which of these options we will go forward with. To give a simple example, which is very convincing, if your principle is maximization and you have two plates of chocolate and one has more chocolate and one has less chocolate, then if you are me, there's a very clear answer. The plate with more chocolate wins. If you have a plate with chocolate and mango and one with only chocolate, then you might prefer the one with the mango. But then the quantities would matter as well, and they would come into your assessment. But if you have a number of things you are judging at the same time, you might be able to rule out some plates because the mangoes are not ripe, or some because there are not enough mangoes or not enough chocolates. But you might still be left with some set of plates that you would tolerate as being, in a sense, equally good, although different. And it's that set which Sen believes we can come to by the use of different principles. So we could talk about that more in discussion, but I will leave that now so as not to delay us further. So that's the basic shape of human flourishing that this secular, indeed atheist, philosopher has put forward, trusting in others to fill it in. But now, a key question which recurs among all who have touched on this approach. What freedoms and functionings are valuable? Is it valuation that we are ultimately concerned with, and how do we go about doing it? How are capabilities to be selected, prioritized, and amended when they have become out of date? How are value conflicts among us to be resolved, and where does authority rest? As I mentioned, Sen's capability approach is deliberately incomplete. He is far less concerned with taking and defending a particular course of action than with showing how the capability approach can be shared by people with diverging philosophical systems. And the intuition behind this foundational plurality is to allow economists to work on pressing issues on which they can obtain some degree of consensus, perhaps not on the fundamentals, but on practical issues. And his concern is with ruling out patently unjust, inefficient, or otherwise acceptable possibilities, rather than identifying a complete and perfect ordering of options. And this incompleteness can seem evasive and willowy, but is one of the key strengths of his approach, and one reason that I think it would be a candidate at this time, when there is a call within economics for wider conceptions of well-being, a candidate to fill that gap. But in practice, we need to decide, and I have found it quite useful in practice to sidestep at this point to a different author whose structure of thought is similar to Sen's, but who has made some important additional contributions. John Finnis is an Australian professor of jurisprudence at Oxford and at Notre Dame in Indiana, and he writes on matters of Catholic Christian moral theology. His writings are in a different discipline than Sen's, but there are parallels between them, and both come from an Aristotelian set of roots. In particular, both put forward human flourishing as squarely the end of their professional endeavors, Sen as an economist, Finnis as a theologian and legal scholar. Before I turn to the details of Finnis's thought, I should say that what appeals to me is the structure of the thought, not the particular conclusions he has arrived at in relation to contraception or to homosexuality or even to just war. On those I would differ and be able to articulate the reasons for that difference. But the structure of the thought remains for me very compelling and promising. And once again, although he comes from Christian and Catholic roots, it is a compelling structure of thought, even in a secular space, for reasons that I will try to clarify. Finnis then does try to specify how can we think about the dimensions, at least, of the human good, of human flourishing, the dimensions in which people will value capabilities and have reason to value those capabilities. And he grounds his foundational account of the human good not in any theoretical approach that comes from a religious faith, although, as I said, that is his own starting point, but rather in practical reason. Practical reason is the intelligent direction towards human fulfillment, and each of us use it every day, perhaps not thinking about it at the time. For example, if you wanted to recapture your recent train of practical reasoning, you might remember what you've done over this past week and ask yourself, why did I do that and that and that? And also looking around, why did others do what they were doing this week? And Finnis suggests that if you ask this question often enough and in a repeated way about the same action, you will begin to see a pattern. In fact, he argues, you will come to recognize, and I quote, a discrete, heterogeneous set of the most basic and simple reasons for acting, which reflect the complete range of kinds of valuable human states and actions. For example, I might ask, why did you take a long walk in the showers this afternoon? To which you might reply vaguely, because it seemed fun. I would ask again, utterly baffled, why? To which you might reply, giving me a further inkling of your reason, I wanted to feel the spring rain, and I needed some exercise. I would persist, as only a toddler or a philosopher can, to ask again why, to which you might explain with your boundless patience, it is simply good to feel healthy and to be in nature. In other words, the simplest reason you give to explain your actions refers to something you recognize as bodily health and as harmony with nature. So in reflecting on this very basic but also intuitive question, why do I and others do what we do, Finnis argues that a person begins to observe the most general reasons for action that he or she has implicitly grasped by their own understanding to be valuable, grasped by practical reason to be valuable. She is following the thread of her own thought processes to their roots. And Finnis argues that when we distill our reasoning to its essence, it will not be reduced to one factor. It will not all be desire satisfaction or giddy pleasure or some sense of life satisfaction. Rather, he thinks it will be several things. It will be multidimensional, in my words. Although his list changes over time, a sample set of categories that I've found very useful are seven topics: life, meaning health, reproduction, and safety from violence. Knowledge and understanding, which includes skills as well as education, as well as wisdom. Human relationships ranging from the most intimate to the exchange with the cashier and the checkout counter. Meaningful work and play, which encompasses the person's vocation to, and what they have to give to their society. Practical reason, which is in a sense your ability to shape your own life, but also to engage politically or in a leadership role. Self-integration, which is in a sense the integration between your emotions, your thoughts, and your behaviors, a sense of inner peace. And harmony with a greater than human source of meaning and value, which can include religion, harmony with God and the gods, he says, but also nature or music or the arts or even romance. So these are categories. These are not specific capabilities, but they are categories that recurrently people might come to when they reflect on their own activities and those of others. And Finnis argues there's no magic list, there's no magic number, there's no particular set of names that we will all come to, but that there will be some kind of similarity when people undertake this exercise. And he argues that the list we come to, that these kinds of goods we recognize to be valuable, are not yet moral. And I'll list off very quickly some of their characteristics that he thinks that they have, because I'm running behind in time. First of all, they're pre-moral, which means that a terrorist might also act in solidarity with their home community. They might act in a destructive, a vicious, and a cruel way, but they would still be acting, in a sense, under the auspices of a good objective. A robber may obtain money by mugging to buy paintings so that he can enjoy their beauty, but it's still a mugging. Second, that the dimensions are common for individuals and societies. So whereas economists would tend to fracture the individual good and the social good, Finnis sees a continuum. Third, that they are, in a sense, self-evident, that anyone who has experience and openness could recognize them for themselves. Fourth, that they are incommensurable, which is that no one of them can be placed in a permanent hierarchy over the others, but they could all be the most important at a given point in time, although they may not ever be important for a particular person who may have no affinity with any particular good. He also argues we should try to seek a set which is irreducible, which cannot be made any shorter. And so the only thing that they have in common, in a sense, is that their pursuit or the actualization of the potentials that they represent could contribute in its own unique way to human flourishing, and that human flourishing is in some way the symphony of these different aspects of the human life playing together in different ways for different people and in different ways for different communities and cultures. In my own work, I used Finnis's list of basic goods, first of all, to compare it with those that have come up by secular people who work on social indicators, with psychologists who look at cross-cultural values, at voices of the poor and studies which go to poor communities and ask poor people what their experience of poverty leads them to say that poverty is and that well-being is. And also to others who have written on the basic needs tradition and tried to articulate the most essential and core needs of the human life. And what is interesting is indeed the commonality between these different lists. Just to give two examples, in Bhutan, the Gross National Happiness Index, which was arrived at completely independently of any of these academic discussions by a combination of people within that state, has elements that are very similar to this: health, education, and the standard of living, including work, time use, governance, environment, community, culture, and religion, and one that I have forgotten. It will come back in a moment. So they have emotional well-being, is the ninth dimension. So there is a similarity, and the Sarkozy Commission dimensions, which they identified as being central to the quality of life, that commission being headed by, or that subcommittee being headed by a psychologist who works on happiness, bore a direct similarity to those dimensions. So in a sense, one question is whether we could use such an underspecified and yet richer account of human flourishing as a centerpiece for economics, perhaps at some points allowing or encouraging governments and communities to specify it in their own particular way, and perhaps at the international level also discussing whether there would be an appropriate and could be an appropriate international measure which would have at least some of these elements more directly specified and measured, and which could be used therefore practically as a metrics that represent better what our economy should be aimed towards. Now, I say this, and I am quite self-conscious that among an audience that may be experienced in theology or in religious studies or in these kinds of disciplines, that this may sound quite rudimentary. But recall, I request, the audience that we are trying to communicate to. You know the story. A man was walking along the road in the countryside and comes across a shepherd and a huge flock of sheep. He tells the shepherd, "I bet you $100 against one of your sheep that I can tell you the exact number in your flock." Now the flock is quite big, so the shepherd accepts the bet. 973, says the man. The shepherd is astonished and says he is exactly right. "I'm a man of my word," he says, "so take an animal." The man picks one up and begins to walk away. "Wait," cries the shepherd. "Double or nothing, I can guess your exact occupation." The man says, "Sure. You're an economist for a government think tank," says the shepherd. "Amazing," responds the man. "You are exactly right. But tell me, how did you know?" "Well," says the shepherd, "put down my dog and I'll tell you." So sometimes it's useful to spell things out a bit for economists. So the suggestion is that some of these very rudimentary ideas could inform at least a richer metrics of well-being. And once perhaps the rough shape is made, then the business of quantification, which is much more familiar, could begin to engage a bit more effectively. So in a sense, this is the cause for hope that the, as I mentioned, the space for change within economics has never been higher. And further, that perhaps there are ideas available that are not so far away and would not require so very much work in order for them to meet the demand for well-being. And further, in a sense, it is when economics has returned to this moral ground that it has changed. It's very interesting. Some of us studied the rise of free market economics and the strategies, both intellectual, political, financial, and organizational, which the economists used to advance free market economics. And one of them was a coordinated center for research called the Mont Pelerin Society. And in his first paper and address to that society, Friedrich von Hayek wrote that it was the socialists' courage to be utopian which gave their profession a kind of authority and which had, in the previous era of economics, brought socialist economics, which was now the rival they were trying to undermine, to prominence. And so whatever the new economics is, perhaps it is a moment to try to regain again that courage to be utopian. So that's the happy side of the talk. And very briefly now, I will try to pinpoint, I think, the reason that, and these are very real reasons, that it is unlikely to go forward. And there are five of them. The first is that welfare economics, unfortunately, is extinct. Welfare economics was that branch of economics which was normative, which was ethical, which was focused on trying to link economic policies to the human good. And it has had different phases of resurgence and renewal. However, it is not taught anymore in undergraduate courses. Oxford, still these days, you cannot get an economics degree. You have to do it with philosophy in the PPE course or now with management. And yet welfare economics, this moral foundation, is no longer taught, whereas once economics was a branch of moral philosophy. And Tony Atkinson, one of our center's advisors and a senior economist in Britain, wrote of the strange disappearance of welfare economics. For he observes that economists proposing specific macroeconomic policies often simply cannot tell you how these will impact people's lives. They've not been trained and they do not have the tools to follow through that question and say what is the impact of a change in foreign exchange rate on human flourishing or well-being. And social objectives at this point are rarely made explicit or even thought through in the making of economic policy. And so while the word welfare has faded from affection, it seems dated and old-fashioned, the need for a clear moral basis for economics and policy has not. But there has been, even in recent times, and I can tell you I follow the news very closely, there has not been a reestablishment of this or even a call for it at a fundamental level in any serious capacity. The second are data issues. If tomorrow we knew the dimensions of human flourishing that we would wish to advance, the, in comparison with economic data, data on human flourishing or indeed on poverty is particularly weak and missing. To give one very basic example, we have, as
Robert mentioned very late last night, finished a poverty measure for 108 countries. And we wished it to be quite an innovative measure, a measure that reflected poverty in its many different aspects. But we needed to do it for 100 countries. And so scouring every single data set that we could, we found that we simply did not have data to have a measure that included anything other than health, education, and standard of living. And of that, the dimension of health is very weak indeed. So tomorrow, even if we had some adequate notion of human flourishing, we would not be able to measure it. We would not be able to track progress over time at all. A second problem with the poverty data, but also with other data, is that they are collected only very periodically. Quarterly, we have data on labor force. Every year, we have data on important economic indicators, and yet surveys on poverty or indeed on wider aspects of human well-being occur every 3 years and in some cases every 5 years. And so people ask, what is the impact of the financial crisis on the poor? And we cannot answer that because the data will not be in for another 4 years. The investments that we have let us down at a time when we have a great deal of information about a great deal of other things. And even the data in developed countries on which I do not work have tremendous gaps. Household survey data does not include the homeless or the military, those who are institutionalized in mental hospitals or in nursing homes. And so there are significant gaps, or in prisons, to our understanding of human flourishing and groups that are to whom we are completely blind. The third is simply a technicality that because economics has focused so much on income, a unidimensional measure, many of the methodologies that we have, not only for measurement, but for analysis, simply focus on one dimension. And so I'll move on very quickly and put this together with the fourth point to say that so the models that we would need to analyze and to try to advance a wider understanding of human flourishing are not at this moment in existence. So, for example, the Stern Review on Climate Change implemented PAGE 2002 as their welfare economics model. And that's a unidimensional model. And the reason that they did so was not that they wished to. Nick Stern and the Commission wished to have a model that would link climate change to human health, education, consumption, and the environment, and would do so in a dynamic way over time. They looked, as you might expect, every place that they could, but no such model existed. And so they had to use a model that did exist, which was a unidimensional one. And this is striking because modern economics is characterized at this time more than any other by quantitative modeling, and yet the models are very underdeveloped in some ways. And the last, scooting on to the end, is in a sense a lack of research coordination. And this is where not only economists, but citizens, indeed religious groups, could have a very powerful voice to play. To give a bit of background, the professional culture among economists is very individualistic, and you are encouraged as a graduate student to work alone, and you are encouraged to publish alone, and not to have a lot of authors on your papers. And so the culture of coordination has not been so great. However, going back to when free market economics was developed, there was much more of an intellectual community, and there were groups that coordinated their research in a way that tried to develop a common set of ideas, not in a very dogmatic way at the time, but in a way that each of them were able to specialize under a new heading and try to develop very practical tools and techniques, knowing that their colleagues in other universities were working on a different part of the same puzzle, and that every year, every 2 years, they would come together and see how their work was building a greater whole. In the wake of the financial crisis, one would have expected that some commission would have been set up that would at least address the financial issues, if not also the issues of well-being and climate change. But no such commission has been set up. And so it would be, one would argue, necessary
given the complexity of the task, the political complexities I've not even spoken of, but also the technical ones, to set up something like the IPCC for economics, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that would orient economics towards human well-being on a shared planet. And it would include economists from all the other bits of the field that don't know each other, the neuroeconomists, the behavioral economists, the macroeconomists, the micro, the computer programmers and the software designers, the specialists on poverty dynamics and on climate change. And it would need not only competent and articulate leadership, but also the younger people who know the computers and who know the newer data and the sources of data from cell phones and other sources. Its first job could be to implement and analyze some very concrete measures of well-being, for these are low-lying fruit and could be done very swiftly using existing data. But after 10 years, the final report and the final set of outputs would need to be much thicker and more extensive. And so the question, and in a sense the surprise, is that this kind of coordination is not being attempted, and also that groups outside of the profession, those who might have a vested interest in shaping it and reorienting it, who might want to take the place that politicians had taken, as Daron Acemoglu said, in the previous era, are not also raising their voices and calling for such changes. And again, the group that von Hayek started that did try to generate a coherent system of free market economics was much more attuned to and engaging with popular culture. And he deliberately cultivated the understanding of people whom he called secondhand traders in ideas, doctors and clergy and lawyers and mothers and nurses, because these were the people whose voices would put pressure on the politicians and who would ultimately demand and benefit from the economics that they created. So to conclude, economics is poised to change. Within a decade, it will be different. And so how should we best encourage the remaking of economics such that it engages with issues of human flourishing? In the conclusion of a different genre, Fear and Trembling, Soren Kierkegaard muses on the problem of convincing philosophers and theologians about the difficulty yet importance of his particular topic, which was faith. But I think his quote is relevant for us too. And so I cite it here. Is not the thing most needed an honest seriousness which dauntlessly and incorruptibly points to the tasks, an honest seriousness which lovingly watches over the tasks, which does not frighten men into being over hasty in getting the highest tasks accomplished, but keeps the tasks young and beautiful and charming to look upon, yet difficult withal and appealing to noble minds. For the enthusiasm of noble natures is aroused only by difficulties. This evening has been devoted to trying to articulate the possibilities of reestablishing an economics with a more adequate notion of human flourishing and the challenges of doing so, in the hope, in part, that so doing might recruit the enthusiasm of more noble natures to this work. Thank you.